More trains pass through Chicago than almost anywhere else in the country, and that traffic affects rail travel throughout the whole state, and help might finally be on the way in the form of $132 million from the federal government. Plus, Jim Bakker is a street artist who has taken it upon himself to fill more than 50 potholes. You know it's him because he also creates mosaics where those potholes used to be. Here he is speaking to Lee Cohen on CBS Sunday Morning.
And I'm always worried about the cops, you know? And I've never had any...
Fair point.
I'm too old to be arrested. I've got, you know, twin boys.
But first, if you struggle with your smart device, then imagine if you had a digital assistant that did everything for you.
I walk into work in the morning. Here's what I see.
Hi, Eric. No one has stopped by to see you since we last talked. Catch you later. Bye-bye.
As Microsoft researcher Eric Horvitz during a TEDx talk about artificial intelligence. Today, we'll revisit a conversation with him. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks to Cass Harrington for filling in while I was away. Coming up on today's program, we're going to be talking about bumps in the road we all face when trying to travel throughout the state, whether you're stuck on a train on the way to Chicago or running into potholes on the way to work. And we wanted to invite you to join us for tomorrow's program when we talk about the immigration crisis that's happening on our border with Mexico. There's been heartbreaking images and sounds like this. That's ProPublica audio of children at detention centers that has swept the national conversation. It's one our lawmakers are having here in Illinois as well. Governor Bruce Rauner has condemned the separation of children from their families. And here's Congressman Mike Bost from Southern Illinois.
If you were caught shoplifting at a local store and you had children with you, while you were going through the process, you would be separated.
That's Congressman Mike Bost speaking to the Belleville News Democrat reporter Joe Bustos. Do you agree with Congressman Bost or not? Leave us a voicemail and we'll play them on the air tomorrow. Again, we want to hear from you how you feel about the current Trump administration policy of separating children from families at the border. That number is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121 to leave us a voicemail. Of course, we're on Twitter at 21STShow. Thanks for listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For your simple needs, Siri or Alexa or any Google Home device can be a great assistant. But if you ask her to add something to your calendar or play a song, she can usually handle it. Imagine, though, trying to have a full conversation with her. I've done it. It does not work. Researchers at Microsoft are working on ways to do just that and much more, though. Artificial intelligence, or AI as it's called, is actually already often used in our lives. And we're thinking about GPS systems, when your new iPhone unlocks by looking at your face. But AI has the potential to affect our lives in many broader ways as well. Eric Horvitz is an expert in artificial intelligence and a director at Microsoft Research Labs. He also helped start a 100-year-old AI study at Stanford and contributed to a new book called The Future Computed, Artificial Intelligence and Its Role in Society for Microsoft. He was in Champaign-Urbana earlier this year to address computer science students at the University of Illinois. He was at our Urbana studios, and I started by asking him just how much we're interacting with AI without even realizing it.
There's an amazing amount of what I would call AI under the hood. And it's been there for a couple of decades now or even more. For example, it's amazing to understand that all of our handwritten addresses right now in the United States are zooming through a system, saving millions of dollars a year, looking at reading addresses automatically, no matter how poorly you write them.
By the Postal Service.
By the U.S. Postal Service. This has been in place since the late 90s. If you use a Windows laptop, the machine continues to learn about you privately in the privacy of your own laptop, and it's always guessing your next move, and it's pre-launching and pre-fetching to make things faster so it's there when you touch a key or launch an application, using the really nice, fun machine learning, as it's called.
So I think when some people hear that, they probably freak out. Like, that sounds a little creepy that your machine is learning a little bit about you. Can you explain a little bit more about what predictive learning is and what it's designed to do?
Well, I think concerns arise because a lot of AI these days is fueled by data, including data that we generate when we use the web, for example. So it's very important for companies like Microsoft and competitors like Google and Facebook to make sure that data is kept private. People understand how it's being used. They buy off on it when they sign up for a service. It's deleted over time and so on and handled very carefully. But the idea basically is we try to learn to predict, to provide, to personalize news feeds, to understand how to diagnose diseases from symptoms by looking at large data sets. So let's go back to that medical example. I've been involved with several projects where we've taken, with very, very strict privacy policies, large amounts of data over like 15 years of a hospital to try to understand how to build a system that can predict based on symptoms of this patient coming in the emergency room or in the hospital, what's going to happen next, what are the highest risks, what diseases are present. And you can do this with systems that learn how to pool this data into these we call predictive models that then can be applied in a personal way for a particular patient, for example. Will this patient be readmitted in 30 days after the discharge, which is a very important risk? And we have systems that we created that can do that kind of reasoning, pooling over a decade of data from hospital records.
And so that all falls under the rubric of AI. How do you think the layperson should think about what artificial intelligence is and what it means?
Well, back in 1956 or so, the phrase artificial intelligence, AI, was first used in terms of a proposal for a summer workshop at Dartmouth, where folks were going to get together and solve lots of problems that summer to figure out how to solve problems that were in the domain of human beings, things that required people to solve. And they talked about the challenges of understanding language, of seeing, perceiving, of planning and decision-making, and learning, adapting over time with information and observations. And so they took these pillars and they said, let's try to build a field. Now people, we look at this as looking towards a science, an actual science of intelligence, like an aerodynamics for decision-making and perception. In some ways, we're touching, and this was what people get sensitive about, we're touching up against a realm of that's been the domain or dominion of humans in terms of human intellect. We're getting better at doing things that we always thought we needed people to do.
So there's a great example of this. You gave a TEDx talk in Austin a couple of years ago, and you have an assistant at your office at your door. And so how does this, before we play the interaction, is this assistant, is it just an interface that comes up when someone comes to your door, or is it just a voice that talks to you?
Oh, no, there's a beautiful or handsome, depending on the day. We use male and female. We even change skin color to not have one particular persona, but as a floating head on a little screen on a pole by my door.
Okay.
And it's actually, generated to not be exactly human-like. It's kind of a little cartoony, but the system can see, hear, interact with dialogue. It knows my calendar, knows important email coming in, understands how busy I am by looking at my desktop activity and listening to my office to see if I'm chatting with somebody. And it actually works with people to schedule appointments, tell them where I might be, when I might be coming back, how to get in touch with me, takes messages. So it actually will say, well, he's not here, but you want to tell me what's up? And he'll nod his head and listen, and then let me know later.
So let's hear a little bit of an interaction. And what's the name of your assistant?
You know, we had names. We decided to back off and say, the assistant.
Okay, so this is the assistant interacting with a Microsoft intern.
Here's Johanna.
Hi.
Are you here looking for Eric?
Yep.
Eric is talking with someone.
I can see that.
And this might take a while.
Oh.
But I don't think he'd mind a brief interruption right now. Okay. You could check back in 15 minutes or so, and we can see if he's available then.
Okay.
So what we don't get for that, we'll tweet out the link so everyone can watch the video, because there's these priceless expressions that she has on her face when she's interacting with your assistant, where the look of horror on her face when she says, oh, you can interrupt him now. You can very clearly, like, she's just like, I don't want to do that. That to me is an interesting example, though, of the way that we're relating to all. So there's sort of like the human side of this, and then there's the machine side of this. How do you think our lives have adapted I realize I've adapted my language to talk to Alexa, because when I'm talking to her, if I speak like a normal person, she won't understand me.
You know, the part of the technology and the push is to make these interfaces more natural. Even today, the assistant by my door, we've worked really hard, in fact, with some great interns that have joined us, to make her more natural, or him more natural, in terms of facial expressions, understanding the nuances of conversation. So the technology, I think, will come a long way over time to join us and be more natural over time. People can expect, I think, over the next 5 to 7 years or so, for these devices, you know, whether it be the Cortana or Siri, Alexa, to start having more natural conversations that actually go beyond a command, like set timer or next meeting. More like talking about the weather and getting to the airport on time, and the way we talk to friends and colleagues, multiple topics popping and pushing, as we call them, on a stack in a natural way. We will be having actual fluid conversations with intelligences that are here to support us in various ways. And some will be very much like personal butlers.
I'm speaking with Eric Horvitz. He's a technical fellow and he's the director at Microsoft Research Labs. And when we think about that, it's a couple years old now, an incident with a bot that Microsoft created, Tay, that was released out onto the world via Twitter. And for people who don't know, like in less than 24 hours after her arrival on Twitter, she had gained more than 50,000 followers. And the problem was she started mimicking their language and voicing some fairly awful sentiments about Nazi sympathies and anti-female language, just bad language in general. And I wonder, would you consider that artificial intelligence? What did you all learn from that at Microsoft in terms of how this, the interplay will happen between people and machines?
Well, let me first say that that system in particular wasn't a deep piece of AI. It was largely a rule-based powered system, but that doesn't mean the learnings, the teachings don't go deep for AI systems or any advanced technology we put out into the world to interact with people and society more broadly in terms of being very careful at thinking deeply through a technology and its influences, being very humble about the complex admixture of when you add human beings to a technology. You really can't predict how it's going to go sometimes. You have to watch carefully. You have to be able to pull back, modify, refine technology. At Microsoft, about a year ago, we created a committee called Ether. It stands for AI and Ethics in Engineering and Research. It has a set of subcommittees that span all the way from how do we think about sensitive uses of AI, like visual recognition, facial recognition systems in sensitive areas like criminal justice and policing. How do we think about biases that might show up in these systems when they're used to give advice, when the data sets they learn from might be biased in terms of race and gender, in particular poor representation of minorities in those systems, among other challenges? And then can we build safe, robust, or trustworthy systems that can explain themselves to people, that people will come to trust because for good reasons? You know, I'm one of the rare AI aficionados that's been in a Tesla autopilot accident, you know, where my own car hit something that it shouldn't have hit while I was on the phone, after I came to trust it over a period of months on the same street. These are really interesting issues as we build and field technologies that will come into our lives, especially in areas that are safety critical, like healthcare, transportation.
So what kind of things are you telling the students, the future engineers of today? I'm fascinated by I can't imagine what's going on at the University of Illinois in terms of engineering and computer science, certainly a lot of cutting edge research. What kind of things are you telling the engineers who are learning all of this now?
Well, the first thing I do is talk about why I am inspired by this area. I think this technology is going to have so many impressive and deep benefits to humanity. Agriculture. We have systems now that can help farmers to do precision agriculture, to understand their soils, that can watch over and fuse information and make predictions as to even, you know, when to sow crops given many different feeds coming in, healthcare, accessibility. I think that I've just been so impressed with some technologies that we've been able to feel, just even though they're preliminary, that help people who are sight impaired to see better. Now, at the same time, after we go through the positives, I like to sort of say, let's take a deep breath and step back and always consider the possible rough edges that might come along.
And as we think about that, Eric, I'm just wondering in terms of, as we're thinking about all of this technology, you mentioned something about news feeds. Certainly that's been part of the conversation about how we get our news. There's technology that exists out there now where you can actually even just use facial recognition and create complete fake news of, like, it looks like the president is saying something they're not. So for people who are worried about all of those counters, how are technology companies like Microsoft trying to work against that?
Let's step back again. You know, would we give up fire as humanity, even though it's being applied in cruel and unsurprising ways? We still have the world of civilization, electricity and machines. Technologies are fairly neutral. We have to worry about criminal uses of AI, just like we have to worry about criminal uses of anything or malevolent usages. I and my wife funded, and we endowed Stanford about 6 years ago or so, 5 years ago now, on a study called the 100-Year Study of Artificial Intelligence. If you go to that website, ai100.stanford.edu, you can read a framing memo we created with 18 areas of concern. Now, one of those areas of concern we called AI democracy and freedom. Could these systems, these precision reasoning systems that learn from data, learn how to manipulate human minds, whether it be through creating new kinds of imagery, as you suggested, which can be done now, or through just understanding what to say to you over time, over weeks or months, from multiple aspects of your life, to shift your beliefs, to obfuscate something, to make you think differently? We have evidence now that's possible, and I would like to raise our awareness of this possibility and then think through what might best protect people, what might best protect our individuality, our independence of thought, our democracy, or democracies across the world, when malevolent uses of AI could be powerful and could be manipulative.
Lots to think about. We will tweet out those links that Eric mentioned if you're interested in learning a little bit more about it. Eric Horvitz is the technical fellow and director at Microsoft Research Labs. Thanks for being with me, Eric. I appreciate it.
It was fun talking to you.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you've ever felt stuck on a train on a way to or from Chicago, you're not alone. Nearly 1,300 freight and passenger trains pass through the city every day, making Chicago one of the biggest hubs for train traffic in the country. And for years now, planners and local officials have known that one of the keys to solving problems with delays is the 75th Street corridor on the southwest side of the city. And earlier this month, it was announced that help could finally be on the way from Washington. Five members of our Illinois congressional delegation, including Senators Durbin and Duckworth, have announced $132 million in federal funding for the Chicago Metropolitan Agency on Planning. We're going to hear from one of CMAP's transportation planners in a moment. But first, I'm joined by NPR Midwest correspondent, and I think I'm going to call him our resident transportation geek, David Schaefer. Hey, David, welcome back to the 21st.
Oh, thanks for having me, Nyla. I'm a geek. I'm officially a geek.
Yeah, you're a transportation geek. I think that's a good title, right?
Sure.
I mentioned Chicago being one of the busiest rail hubs in the country. Can you give us a sense, first of all, just how much rail traffic comes through Chicago, and where is that coming from?
Well, it's coming from both coasts. It's coming from Canada. It's coming from the Gulf Coast. It's all something like 25% of all freight moved by rail comes either to, through, or from Chicago. So we have, you know, O'Hare and Midway airports have big cargo operations, so there's freight that may come from overseas that is offloaded off of cargo planes and put onto trains. Six of the seven Class 1 freight railroads in this country all go through Chicago. There are loads that have to go from one railroad, maybe the Canadian Pacific, from the west to CSX going east or south or something like that, or Norfolk Southern. So it's just a spaghetti junction of so much rail and so much freight. It's really a linchpin to the entire freight transportation network in the country. And there used to be a measure of just how bad it was, that the legend was that it could take 2 days for a freight train to get from the West Coast, Los Angeles or Long Beach port to Chicago, and another 2 days to get through Chicago. That has been reduced to some degree in recent years. I think the drop has been from 40-some hours to 30-some hours, but it is still a huge bottleneck in the freight transportation system in this country.
And so not just freight, for passengers. I feel like I have sat on Amtrak trains for, it feels like, 2 days. I think my record was once, I think it was 3.5 hours, David. We were sitting at around 57th Street on the south side on a passenger train. How will this money that was just announced for the 75th Street corridor, how will that improve not just delays for freight, but also for passengers? Will that change that?
Absolutely, because one of the biggest problems with passenger rail is that most of the passenger railroads, including Metra and Amtrak, are using freight tracks. They have some of their own tracks, especially in the Chicago area where it starts to get so congested. But oftentimes, and in the 75th Street corridor in particular, a passenger train may have to wait for a freight train to clear. And sometimes those freight trains aren't just going somewhere. They're just trying to get into a yard where their loads will be offloaded, or they'll pick up new loads, or loads will be switched to other trains to different directions and that sort of thing. And if the yards are full and the train can't get in, a freight train may sit for a while, and it'll block tracks that are used by the passenger rails too. So this one junction area, this 75th Street corridor, has over 100 trains going through it each day. And you know, about, I would guess, three quarters of them are freight trains, but there's, you know, 32 or so Metra and Amtrak trains too, as well as close to 100 freight trains. So it's really like 130 trains each day going through this one junction area. So if you don't untangle that, if you don't separate the tracks a little bit, you're going to affect everybody in the system, and that includes passenger rail.
David, when I saw this announcement come through from Senators Durbin and Duckworth about this $132 million, I emailed you and I asked you how big of a deal this was in terms of infrastructure. Do you mind sharing what your response was?
I don't know that I recall.
Yeah, you said it was just a big deal. I think you said it was a pretty big deal.
It is a pretty big deal. It's something that the state of Illinois has been waiting for a long time. One of the reasons it didn't happen under the Obama administration is because the freight railroads were a little reluctant to pony up some of their own money. We hear a lot in transportation funding conversations these days about public-private partnerships, and the freight railroads do maintain and take care of all of their own track. They don't look to the government like the government takes care of the highways. This is done by the railroads themselves. But when it came to untangling this, they were leery of, you know, well, one railroad's paying more than the other, or how come we're being asked to pay for this when we don't benefit quite as much? Finally, they got everybody on board. I think it was just about 2 years ago, maybe. I might have the timing off, maybe a year and a half ago. But it did get passed on to the Trump administration, and there have been delays. But the thing is that a lot of people weren't thinking that the Trump administration would even show much interest in benefiting urban areas around the country. And the preponderance of funding that we've seen come through these types of grants this year have gone to rural areas. In this region, for example, Interstate 94 is getting a pretty big chunk of change between the Illinois state line and Milwaukee. That's a benefit to the Foxconn factory that's being built there in Racine County. And in other states, it's gone to a lot of rural highway projects. So to untangle freight rail, to have a benefit to commuter rail and to Amtrak, is a bit of a surprise, I think, to a lot of people in transportation circles. But this is something that has been on the want list for the Chicago region for a long, long time.
And it's certainly something President Trump, he talked about infrastructure a lot, particularly during his first year, saying that he wanted to invest in infrastructure across the country.
He has, and he's talked about, you know, being sort of an infrastructure president. We're going to build the biggest, the brightest, the newest, the shiniest. You know, he talks about gleaming rails around the country. And so this isn't the kind of sexy project, though, that a lot of people will be like, ooh, look at that great new bridge, or look at that great new expressway or terminal or something like that. But it is desperately needed in the Chicago region.
Speaking of shiny, sexy projects, I wanted to ask you about Elon Musk, the announcement that his company is going to be has been awarded a contract, but will be building a high speed train from O'Hare to downtown Chicago in 12
nice
minutes.
Segue, by the way. Yeah. So this is really kind of fascinating. The city of Chicago, the previous mayor, Mayor Daley, has long wanted some better express service than what we have through the CTA's blue line from between downtown.
Yeah, there is no express service, I will say.
There is no, right. I mean, the only express service you get is if you wait until the wee hours of the morning and the Kennedy Expressway is clear, and then you can get there in maybe 20, 25 minutes. Normally, the traffic is pretty bad between downtown and O'Hare, so plan on that being an hour at least. And it takes a good 40 to 45 minutes on the blue line. There have been improvements on some sections of track. There used to be, a whole bunch of slow zones. They've improved the track to get rid of some of those. But this has been a dream previously for Mayor Daley and now for Mayor Emanuel. To really, by really improving that link, that time link, reducing it to, the goal was under 20 minutes, but to have it just be 12 minutes makes O'Hare such a much more vital piece, a vital asset to the business community of Chicago, and to people wanting to do business in Chicago. So, if this comes to reality, it'll be fascinating to see if they can actually make it work. But it would be a huge benefit potentially to the city of Chicago. This is Elon Musk's boring company, and they're promising to take on all of the costs. But it'll be privately run, so they could also make out with a lot of profits.
Right.
We'll have to just see how it all
works.
We'll
have to see how that one works out.
Yeah, and the technology isn't proven, so we don't know if it'll really work. What they're talking about is this sort of Tesla in a tunnel, these vehicles that would run through new tunnels that would have to be dug, and like subway tunnels, but smaller. And these vehicles would hold about 16 passengers, and they'd run, I don't know, maybe every few minutes, but in a kind of a loop between downtown and O'Hare. And if it works, it could be a huge benefit to the city for in the eyes of many people.
That's David Shaper reporting for NPR from Chicago. David, thanks as always for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I'm joined now by Tom Murtha, Senior Transportation Planner for Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning, or CMAP. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Nala. Thanks very much.
Tom, as we were mentioning earlier, David and I were just chatting about that $132 million in federal funding for the 75th Street corridor. As he said, this is something that's been long advocated for and waited on by folks in Chicago. How did it feel to learn that you'd finally be getting these federal dollars?
Well, it is a real pleasure to know that something that really probably, you know, hundreds of people have worked on over the past 15 years or so has really, you know, now a good chance of coming to fruition. And it's not just $132 million in federal funds, but a total of $400 million in funding, both from private sources, the railroads, as well as the partner agencies that are actually, you know, putting the engineering and construction for this program together, the state of Illinois, the city of Chicago, Cook County, Amtrak, Metra, you know, those are the CREATE partners that are really putting this together. And it's a big victory both for those agencies, the region, and the people of Illinois.
And Tom, David was sort of describing how it's kind of this snarled spaghetti of line. It was kind of the picture he painted of particularly that part of that 75th Street corridor. What will this money do?
This money is going to separate one set of railroad tracks from another set of railroad tracks. So this is going to be a a big new shiny bridge. And rail bridges, separating one railroad from another, and rail bridges, because the grades, the slopes of those railroads can't be very great. They're going to be pretty big structures. So the two railroads that conflict will be separated from each other. But in addition, there's going to be a highway crossing of one of those railroads that's also separated. And so the motorists seeking delay or that see delay at that railroad crossing on 71st Street will have that delay eliminated. Also, a companion project in the same corridor also was announced as a grant that the same day that
federal
announcement was made. Columbus Avenue on the southwest side also was awarded a grant of about almost $50 million out of a $62 million project. City of Chicago got that grant to separate Columbus Avenue from the Belt Railroad, again in the 75th Street corridor.
And so, Tom, that's a huge, I think, benefit for folks that are driving within the city of Chicago. How is this going to affect train travel for people all across the state? I'm thinking particularly of our audience across the state who are taking trains into the city.
The biggest benefit will be for users of the Southwest service. And the benefits are really going to be kind of short-term and long-term. Short-term benefits, there'll be greater reliability, less delay from freight interference. And the Southwest service has a great deal of freight interference. So short-term, when this project, phase grade separation is complete, we'll see better reliability. In the long term, this is a two-part project. In the long term, the plan is to increase, to change the station that the Southwest service goes into from the congested Union Station to the less congested LaSalle Street Station, have a flyover for the Southwest service to reach that station, and provide more trains and better service for people. Add more track to the Southwest service. So we'll have better service, more trains, greater reliability, less crowded locations where these trains are going to, all benefits for the general public. In addition to all of the savings that shippers are going to have because of the greater reliability of getting goods moved through Chicago on the train system, on the freight system. So,
yeah, so it sounds like lots of work now that this money has been awarded. We're almost out of time, but Tom, when is all this work going to start?
Let's see. I don't know the exact schedule, but it should be starting within the next year or two.
Okay.
Starting preliminary construction and then again building that very large flyover that people will start seeing pretty soon.
Hundreds of millions of dollars being invested, as Tom Earth is telling us, not just by the federal government, the state, private companies as well, into our infrastructure outside of Chicago and within the city. Tom Earth is a senior transportation planner with the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning. Tom, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Goodbye.
Coming up on the 21st, as we're talking about transportation and infrastructure, we're going to continue that theme with a conversation about potholes and one artist who is now famous for filling them in. He's going to be joining us from Chicago, where he's a graphic and mosaic artist. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We just heard about what's next for rail congestion. Hopefully those of us who take the train will see fewer and fewer delays, especially going into the Chicago area. On the other hand, if you're driving on the road, you probably hit a pothole at one point or another, especially this year. It's pretty bad. And one artist, though, has been taking matters into his own hands for years by not just filling potholes, but adding his own mosaic street art for all to see. Pictures that are whimsical, political. Jim Bakker is a graphic and mosaic artist in Chicago. He joins us now from our studios at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in Evanston. Hi, Jim. Welcome to The 21st.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Jim, so I think we've all seen potholes. We've driven through them. We wish they would get filled sooner rather than later. And I was looking at your Instagram, and I read that 5 years ago last month, one night, you decided you would change that. Can you tell me the story?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's a long story. I'll try to keep it short. But I got into mosaics initially because they're so incredibly durable, specifically the ancient technique. And back in 2013, the pothole season, at least in our street on the northwest side of Chicago, was particularly bad. And there was one stubborn pothole in front of our house that kind of refused to stay fixed. And so I kind of had the idea of merging this passion of this art form that I love so much that was so durable and making a piece of art and fixing that pothole myself.
And is it right that you were first inspired to do mosaic art, which is what you use in these potholes, when you were traveling in Pompeii?
Right. That's, you know, it all started just kind of unexpectedly with a tour guide saying, pointing out a mosaic and saying, you know, this art looks essentially the way the artist intended, because marble and glass don't fade and they're set into mortar. And my background is a designer in the ad biz, so I was already, you know, a creative person, and that just kind of lit my imagination on fire that I could do artwork that could last incredibly long.
Last longer than the pothole, especially when it's a pothole, right? Because I think everyone thinks that potholes, especially in Chicago, it's notorious for potholes that are repaired every year that seem to never, same pothole pops back up again. Can you share with us what this actually involves, both filling the actual pothole and then this mosaic work that you do? How do you do that?
Sure. What happens is all the artwork's done in my studio ahead of time. So I have a 1970 pickup truck that I carry all my supplies with. And so once I find an ideal candidate pothole, I show up there with my truck. I've got the piece of art ready to go. I mix the concrete on site. I've got water and, you know, buckets and mixing stuff and whatnot. Fill the pothole, slide the artwork on top of the wet cement. I won't get into the details too far, but it takes a couple hours to install it. And then once it's good to go, at that point, I kind of protect it with serious traffic cones and maybe a tarp. And then I need to come back, depending on the temperatures, 8 to 10 hours later, once the concrete's hardened, with wire brushes and whatnot. And I scrub it really good and make it look as pretty as possible. Take a bunch of photographs of it because it's as good as it's ever going to look. And then move on.
And is there an ideal size of a pothole? I remember in Chicago once we had folks to send us pictures and they had people put their children in potholes. It was so big. It was sort of their size. Right. How big of a pothole is ideal for you to do your work in?
It's 18 by 24 inches. I actually have a pothole spec sheet I give people, because the most difficult part of the process is finding good ones. I mean, they're all over the place, but if I'm going to spend the time and money to install something, I want it to be in a pothole that isn't on a trash street that's going to get repaved soon or is unstable and whatnot. But 18 by 24 inches, not in the center of the road, because I can't block traffic when I'm doing this stuff. It can't be too deep, can't be too shallow. Like I mentioned, the asphalt on the street needs to be pretty stable to house the art, that it's going to stick and stay there for a period of time.
So I feel like you've probably learned a lot about our road infrastructure as you've done this.
Reluctant expert, I guess.
And now, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's just like, you know, you just learn all sorts of things about temperature. You know, the first half a dozen or so I did, kind of most of them failed because of lessons learned about protecting them and making sure that that cars aren't going to run over the concrete while it's still wet, or it's too cold and the concrete takes too long to set, and, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff.
And how do you you decide what kind of image to go with? You have everything from a bag of Cheetos to flowers to an ice cream sandwiches to words saying this is not a pothole. My favorite might be the mosaic you did of a Chicago parking ticket. But how do you decide what to do?
Basically, you know, I've got a series of series going on. A common theme I do is called universal truths, meaning I juxtapose a universal hate, potholes. I mean, nobody likes potholes, with something that is kind of like a universal love, like ice cream or flowers. So it's just kind of juxtaposing those two concepts that perhaps somebody is driving or walking down the street and they happen to glance at the street, not expecting anything. And about the last thing you'd expect in a nasty pothole is, you know, a spray of tulips or something like that. So I just think it's kind of funny. It's like an unexpected grin.
It's an unexpected grin. You've developed quite a following both online and in life. I've listed you've had very successful Kickstarter campaigns. Yep. Were you surprised that this kind of public art struck such a chord with so many people?
Totally. You know, and I, you know, in retrospect, you know, this is not what I thought initially, is like it's a universal thing that people can relate to. I mean, I've gotten emails and calls from all over the world because everyone can relate to it, whether you're rich, poor, short, tall, young, old, it doesn't matter. Everyone can relate to it, and pretty much everyone hates them. So, you know, I started the campaign initially. My thing is still fine art mosaics, which you don't really see, things that actually hang up on the wall. I just thought when I started this initially was that this would be a nice little PR campaign to maybe draw attention to my fine artwork. And what has happened over the past 5 years is it's completely taken over. And I don't have much time to do original art anymore. I can sell it, but I don't even have time to make it. So it's kind of funny.
Well, and also I think that's something kind of funny also about public art, right? And I wonder what your thoughts are on it now. That kind of fine mosaic work that you're talking about is something that can be quite expensive, especially for someone to acquire. This is something that you've made available for everyone to enjoy. What has this experience taught you about the nature of public art?
Boy, what has it taught me? That's a good question. It's an amazing... I guess it's just an amazing way to get a message out that just sticks. You know, it's not going anywhere, especially the stuff that I do. You know, it's not going to get painted over or anything like that. So it's just the power of this kind of semi-permanent billboard about whatever you want to say, whether it's something about you or something about politics or something that's just kind of funny that you want to get your dry wit out there for people to kind of, you know, maybe appreciate or something. It's an amazingly powerful form of getting, you know, the message out that stays out there while you continue on with your life doing other things.
And I wanted to ask you about, speaking of political, a pothole that you did last year, kind of near the Trump Tower. It's a mosaic that says the word liar superimposed on a Russian flag. Mm-hmm. Is that one still around?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's in great shape. I love the whole idea behind that piece, and I love the story afterward because that kind of really came out of left field for what I do. You know, almost all my work is very upbeat or light or funny or whatever, and this kind of came out of nowhere and surprised everybody, annoyed some people, lost some followers, gained some followers. You know, so it was just a very interesting experience because 99.9% of the time reaction to my work's been positive. And that's the one piece where there was a percentage, a very small percentage, but there was a few people that weren't happy with me. The other bonus I just like to throw in with that particular piece is there's actual gold in the piece. There's the perimeter is done with a very expensive type of gold that has actual gold leaf adhered to the top. So
wow.
I like the idea of something of a little bit of value being, you know, stuck in the street like that.
And all of this is not necessarily legal.
I don't know.
How does it work? Do you ever have encounters? I'm thinking about as you're doing this, I wonder how does that work when you're showing up and you've got hours of installing and having concrete? And I like the idea that you're setting out parking cones. Do people think you're working with the city when you're doing this stuff?
Totally. Yeah. You know, and it's like an unintentional consequence. I really do it because I don't want to get hurt, you know, but it just so happens I also look like a city worker. I mean, I learned my lesson about getting small cones. Now I have serious cones. I used to use my boys' soccer cones, and those don't work because they're too small and lightweight and they blow away. So, you know, I learned my lesson there. But, you know, an orange vest and orange cones. So people just think I'm a city worker that's working too hard on one particular piece of, pothole.
And so I should say, for the most part, when city officials are asked about this, they say something along the lines of, oh, we love the spirit of this, but please leave pothole filling to the authorities. What do you think about that?
And, you know, that's, you know, sure. I don't mind. It's funny. That's the only communication I've had indirectly with the city about this, and I've had about a half dozen or so interactions with the police, and those have all more or less have been positive once they know what I'm doing. And now a lot of people, especially in Chicago, know what I'm doing, so they might recognize me as I'm installing stuff. It's like, hey, I know what you're doing. But I even had one interaction with the police on the south. Actually, in the University of Chicago area, and I was working, and I sensed a car pulling up to me, and that's happened before, and sometimes it's just a passenger car, and sometimes it's not. In this case, I looked, and I could see that there's a blue stripe of the Chicago police car, and I'm like, you just don't know. Like I said, I've had about a half dozen interactions, and you just don't know, is this the one where things are going to go sideways? And the guy comes out, and he just kind of looks at me, and he points at me, and he's like, I hear that pothole guy. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, that's so effing cool. So, you know, it's kind of fun how it's, you know, it's unofficially sanctioned, I guess.
Right. And so you're working on a coffee table book with this art. I saw there's a bike tour that you're leading through Chicago. What are you hoping people learn about the city through all of your work?
What am I thinking that people learn about? I don't know. I mean, it's just this, it's such a Chicago thing. I don't know, celebrating, it's gritty, it's Midwestern, it's kind of funny. You get a little exercise at the same time with the bike tour and whatnot. But it's just, I don't know, a little levity that we're all, you know, it just kind of brings everybody together. I bet so many people around the city from all different neighborhoods, because like to my previous point, everyone can relate to it. So it's a fun way to get people together. And then with the pothole book, that all stems from the Kickstarter campaigns. And, you know, when people donate, you want to give them rewards for helping you out. And so depending on the tier, you know, got t-shirts and stickers and whatnot, but some of the higher tiers, I'm offering up the pothole art book. Actually, this is the second edition. The first edition sold out last year. So this edition, it's an edition of 300 signed and numbered books, that was offered to this year's Kickstarter folks, and it's also available on my website, which I think I've got about half gone.
All right. Well, we will tweet out links so you can see Jim's work and find out more information about him. Jim Bakker is a graphic and mosaic artist talking to us about his public art in Chicago and how this movement has also spread throughout the country and the world. Jim, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about families who have been separated at our border with Mexico and the chorus from politicians who are calling for the practice to end. This morning, there's been reports that President Trump plans to sign an executive order as soon as today that would end the separation of children from their parents. This would reverse his administration's policies that began these separations in the first place. Stay tuned to this NPR member station for more on that develops. Meanwhile, this week, there have been Illinois residents like Sarah Dormer, who organized the Rockford Children's March, which will take place on June 30th, along with other grassroots efforts.
When I feel like I am going to cry, I swallow it and I turn that pain and emotion into energy to fight.
We're wondering, we're going to be talking tomorrow about how news of this immigration policy, has it caused you to take action? Are you motivated by policies that protect our borders? We want to hear from you. Please leave us a voicemail and we're going to play it during tomorrow's program. Our voicemail hotline number is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. We want to hear your thoughts about this separation policy of families at the border. You can also visit our website, 21stshow.org, to contact us by email or social media. Again, our website, 21stshow.org, is where just head over to the left and you have ways to leave us a voicemail, send us an email. Especially, we want to hear how you're feeling about this new policy of separating families at the border for tomorrow's program. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day. See you back here tomorrow.